Hi, everybody. My name is Debbie Davis, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Debbie.
And I know it's customary right away to say your sobriety date, and mine is February the 8th, 1976, which means I've been sober a little over 30 years. That also means that I got sober when I was four, okay? And I am just so delighted to be here, and I am just so honored to be your first speaker at your first conference, and I just thank you, Larry, the committee, for this pleasure and privilege. It is nothing short of complete Texas hospitality since Kent and I arrived, and the whole time through, and I just want to thank you for such a heartfelt honor to be here, and I'm grateful, and I'm so glad to see so many friends and meet so many new ones, and I hope that you will be doing the same thing. And there's a couple of things that we say in meetings in where I come from in California, and that one of them is please take a moment to silence your pagers and cell phones and all any noise-making equipment. And the other thing we do is we ask for newcomers. And just if you're in your first 30 days of sobriety, would you just raise your hand so we can see where you are? We've got a few people. Great. Wonderful. I want to welcome you to some fun and sobriety. Conferences, for me, have always been the ice cream on the cake because I got to hear people from all over the place share their experience, strength, and hope. And I got to, it just opened up my world. And so you might say, well, you're not really much of a crowd person, but you are tonight. And we welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we do have a lot of fun here. But we also take, or I also take this path very seriously. And I really love what Kurt read, that last part in A Vision for You. That is probably my most favorite part in our book because it just summarizes everything for me. And that more will be revealed. And I want to tell you, if you're new, what has worked for me. When I got here and I saw that triangle of recovery, unity, and service, that is a triangle that I work very hard to apply in my life in all areas. In addition to that, for me, though, is my sobriety date, a home group, and a sponsor. As I already shared with you, my sobriety date, it's not my first sobriety date, but it's my current one. And it will stay my current one as long as I continue to do the daily maintenance. Now, what's that? Well, some of those things for me are, I don't take the first drink or anything else that affects me from the neck up one day at a time. I take my physical sobriety very seriously. And for me, that means I don't drink near beer. Okay, I don't smoke near pot. You know, I never got near drunk. You know, I'm either drunk or undrunk. I mean, there just was no middle, goofy, waving around kind of motions. It was on the way to getting drunk, but it never stopped at that spot. I always overshot the mark. It was not accidental. It was intentional. I just always went for the ultimate I could. And so I treat my recovery that way. I want to overshoot the mark in recovery too. I want to do everything I know to do and then a little bit more because I've learned for me that that is my cushion. But it starts with I don't take that first drink. That physical sobriety is what makes anything else in this program able to stick to me, to cling, to have a place to start. I start and close my day in the same manner with the bookends of prayer. I start and close my day, and I choose to do it on my knees because I've developed a relationship with the God of my own understanding that I rely on deeply. I rely on for today's strength to be that buffer between me and any obsession that I may have. And the obsession may not be that of a drink, but it could be of a person or resentment or a want or anything. An obsession is a very negative distraction for me. And so he's that buffer in there for me. And to show me how you want me to be useful. And how I learn how to be useful is I answer my phone without screening my calls. That's one of the ways I get to be of service. And sometimes that can be a very spiritual awakening, and that you kind of wish you didn't have that little rule for yourself, I got to answer this one too. So I do that because I know me. And I know my mind is one that if I start screening those calls, well, then I'm going to start screening more calls, and pretty soon I won't need a phone because I'm not answering it anyway. And I know that about me in every area of my life. And so I just, one day at a time, don't screen my calls. I don't take those kinds of actions. I also know that physical sobriety for me is, as I said before, that launching pad. And because I used to think that's all you did is you just didn't drink and then everything got wonderful and that was really all there was to it, because I had the impression from non-alcoholics that was it, because they asked really good non-alcoholic questions. They would say things like, why do you always have to get drunk? Or, why can't you have a couple like we do? And those are really good questions. But when I don't know anything about that I have an illness on board, and I can tell you lots of reasons why I get drunk and why I don't have just a couple of drinks, what happened is I answered them in the most honest words I'd said in a long time, and I didn't even know it. And it was the total truth, and I said, I don't know. I could have told them I just love to have fun, I just love to get drunk, which was also the truth. But the truth is, I knew it was, I don't know. And until I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, did I know anything about the disease of alcoholism. And so I thought that all you had to do is the not drinking part, and I did that off and on, and I would always get drunk or loaded again until this last time. And it was when I took these steps that my life changed. Because I've tried it, some shortcuts, and it just didn't work. And so that physical sobriety was the launching pad to everything else. It wasn't the only thing, but it was necessary for anything else to happen. So if you are new here and you don't have a sobriety date, I really encourage you to get one, because it'll make a lot more sense when you're sober. It's just a suggestion, okay? And that home group is so vital to me, because that is where I learned so many tools. I really had none of how to interact with you, how to be with people. I'm fine alone, but that isn't the real world. And so I don't allow myself to get into isolation because it's so comfortable for me to be there. You taught me in a home group about commitments, about showing up, about accountability. You taught me how to develop a relationship with a family. I was an only child, and when I took my first drink at 12 years old, everything just shut down emotionally, and I no longer needed or wanted them. And not that that was any kind of a conscious decision, it just seemed to be what happened, and I became internally independent, and my focus was all about drinking. And when I got sober at 18, I made those amends when I went through the steps. And then for the next 14 years, I sort of called them a couple times a year. We all lived in different states by this time, and I liked it like that. There wasn't the guilt of when you're coming over for dinner, you never call, you never this, and blah, 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 blah. We all just kind of stayed in touch a couple times a year. Everybody's still alive, got the same phone number, okay. And at 14 years sober, I thought, I am their only daughter. And it's important to me that I develop a relationship with them. So I listened to how you repaired your relationships. And because one of the things you taught me to do is do what you say you're going to do, what is it that I can do that I can make a commitment to, that I can uphold? Because once again, we hear over and over, I may be the only representation of Alcoholics Anonymous somebody sees. And these are the people who have lived with me and known me all of my life. I want to be a good example and be someone in a better memory for them than they used to have. And so I called them on the first Sunday in January of 1991. And I said, I'm going to call you the first Sunday of the month. And I have not missed that commitment in over, 15 and a half years now. And it's not because I'm wonderful. It's not because, you know, of anything like that. It's because I made a commitment and then I take the responsibility to follow it through. I have a little sticky note that goes from month to month after I've made those calls so I don't miss that first Sunday of the month. That's what I do. I've learned how to take care of the responsibilities and the commitments that I make. He taught me how to be a better employee. Because for me, when I was drinking, you showed up at work when it was convenient, you know. You know, it's not convenient very often is the problem. And, you know, I learned here that you take tradition one into the workplace, that the common welfare of the company comes first, and my little whims and whines and needs come second. And so you taught me how to take all of this into all areas of my life. I have had I've lived in four very different areas of the country. And therefore, I have had four different home groups. And as I learned when I made this last move, that it's kind of strange that I've also had four different last names, okay? Just kind of how that worked out. My current home group, and has been since I moved to Northern California, is the Primary Purpose Group. Meets Thursday nights, 8 o'clock in Dublin, an open speaker meeting, and you all are welcome anytime you're in that Bay Area. Please, please call and come see us. You're welcome, and I'm there. Unless I'm out of town, you'll find me there. And a home group is so vital to me. It's just, those are just a few of the things. I've sat in those meetings when I didn't want to, when I felt absolutely like I did not have a single friend, and the following week you come in and you're in love with everybody. You know, I've sat in those rooms where there's always been a couple of people that I know would be happier in another home group, you know? You know these things. You know, and they didn't move from Minneapolis to Atlanta to Long Beach to Northern California. I did. And I know that I'm just going to be a lot better off if I learn how to get along with the people I get to have. And I love Bill's use of words. They're my great patience and tolerance testers, you know. And I have to think, if I'm thinking that about somebody, somebody's thinking that about me too. So I'm helping them too, you know. And that's, we're all of service. And so I love a home group. And if you don't have one, get in the middle of one. And make it your meeting. Make it yours. Make it better because you're there, because you're active. Take the commitments. Jump in the center of it. I've been a wallflower. Not a wallflower necessarily, but I've held up the walls, okay? No, I've never been a wallflower. With this color hair, you kind of glow in the dark, you know? It's easy to find, But I've held up those walls and tried to be invisible because I just didn't want to join up and be a part of this thing. But there's been no greater life I've experienced than in the middle of you. And so I invite you into the middle. And that third thing is a sponsor. I've had three sponsors in sobriety, a woman named Marguerite W. in Minneapolis, Joe P. in Atlanta, and Millie G. in Southern California, who I still have. She and I have walked this path of sponsorship for over 19 years. She just Wednesday had her 37th AA birthday, and all of these sponsors have had the same attraction for me. They've all been people that I want to be like when I grow up. And, you know, I can't think of a better compliment to somebody than to want to be like them. Because of the way they live, because of the way they act, because of the way you get to see them in all of their affairs is always the same. These people have all been very grounded, very solid, very connected. And I didn't know what that was until I would learn it was their God of their own understanding. They had that light in their eyes that lit up. And that, too, was a reflection of their connection to their God. that's what I wanted, and I'm willing to do what they do to have what they have. And a sponsor has been a great journey for me. It's the person who knows me, beauty marks and warts, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the secrets I don't want to tell anybody, because I need to have one person who knows all of those things, who I have no dark corners with. And so these three things have been the key to my sobriety. I haven't always been the best sponsee. I haven't always been a poster child for my home group. And I haven't always maybe been somebody who's just been right at the top of the list in protecting her sobriety. But I know that one day at a time, I have been grounded to the best of my ability with you. And this has been my journey. But I got to Alcoholics Anonymous via the road of active alcoholic drinking. And I took my first drink when I was 12 years old. It was on a Friday night, and I love Friday nights. I still love Friday nights. They became a magical night for me. And I'd been invited earlier in the week by the cool kids in school, and boy, nothing was going to stop me from going to that party that night. Now, I had heard them talk about drinking. I don't recall anybody talking about being drunk, but I somewhere along the line decided I'm going to get drunk because this is my one and only shot at being accepted by these kids. I've never seen anybody drunk. I don't even know how you get drunk. I'm just probably going to drink a whole bunch. I don't know, but that seems to be the way to do it. And I would be the first person I saw drunk. I am the only identified alcoholic on both sides of my family. The closest we got is a suspect uncle, okay? Not even confirmed. I am the total representative. And what's interesting is the same thing with my husband. So we aren't very good, you know, cases in the hereditary feature. But we do have this disease, and we've represented our families in it. And so when I got to that Friday morning, I had my good thoughts on the first part of my mind, and that was to be a good daughter and obey the rules and stay out of trouble and a good student. Because I'm not a rebel. I am a conformist. I want to do the right thing. I still want to do the right thing. But I that's how I start my day, and I don't like negative attention. And then the second thing on that my mind that day is I'm going to get drunk tonight. And what I don't know is those two things are going to come in direct conflict with each other, you know? When we arrived at that party that night, it's you're 12 and 13 years old. It's kind of like a liquid potluck, you know, whatever you stole or brought or, you know. And you just start mixing and passing around, and there's a brown bag going around with something in it, and I don't know what's in it, but I know what's in it. There's alcohol in there. And I'm watching them, and I don't want to look like I don't know what I'm doing, so I watch what they do. And so when it gets to me, what I saw them do was this, and they took a pull off of that bottle, and they gave it to the next guy. And I did that, and of course, you remember that first drink just rips out your throat, you know? You can always get another throat, you know. Yeah. Don't let that stop you. And what it would do is it went down into this place that nothing had ever gone before, and it did hit that bottom we talk about, and it's like hot lava to me. It's warm, it's quiet, it's thick, and it just silently fills in every hole in my gut, and I don't even know there are any in there. But what happens is my shoulders relax. And I've got this like warm glow about 2 inches behind my belly button, and I'm thinking I'm 12 years old, and you know, oatmeal has never done this for me. You know? I don't know what's in there, but I want some more. And so that more now phrase I heard in early sobriety completely identified with what that meant. And it came around because I wanted the same effect. I took the same action. And I took a pull off of that bottle and I gave it to the next guy and it ripped out my throat again and it did that magic the second time. But if there is a line that we cross from social into non-alcoholic drinking, I had just had the one and only social drink I would ever have. The first one. Because I crossed over something because my life changed between the first and the second drink. The first drink is still, I hope that you accept me. And that second drink went down and became arrogance. And inside I went from hoping you'll accept me to, I sort of internally threw my shoulders back. I looked around that room of kids that night and I thought, hey, aren't they glad I'm here? Please accept me, drink number one, drink number two. Who needs you? And I was into a world that I loved. I was there all by myself. I no longer needed your approval. I don't need to drink with you. I don't need to hang with you. I am so liking this new world. And I don't think of what's just happened. All I know is that I just want to be here all the time. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but when I took that drink, I activated this disease. I activated what I know to be the mental obsession. I told you how I woke up Friday morning, and on Saturday morning I woke up and those things were in reverse. I woke up thinking about drinking. What should I get tonight? Where should I drink it? Who should I have buy it for me? And I don't want to drink with anybody because I have to share, and I'm not a sharer. And so I'm thinking about that, and those good ideals were in spot number two, and eventually they're removed because when the choice comes down to, which it always does, do you drinking or good ideals, they go. There isn't even a debate on it. There is no room. It just crowds out all else. And so I activated that mental obsession that would last for me for the next 6 years. I activated the physical craving. I don't know that when I take on a drunk. I look at it as I just like to have fun. That thing of blacking out, which was just simply memory losses, and the passing out was simply naps. Dry heaves were bad booze, you know. Those things just didn't seem like the negative consequences. It's just stuff that kind of happened. But I didn't look at it in any other perspective because my vision regarding drinking was so straight and narrow. They're just, I have that not about much of anything else, and yet everything I would do for the next 6 years was automatic. I never thought twice about what I would do, where I would go, what I would say, the potential trouble, what it looked like, my reputation, what it would cost. Nothing had a second thought to it. It just was the path that I was on. At 13, I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs. I needed these accessories in my life, which allowed me to drink longer. I found things to help me stay awake longer, which allowed me to drink longer, which was the whole point of any event. And I found things like speed and acid will help you. And they will. You'll get there quicker and in color. That was the combination for me, and certainly the last year and a half of my active drinking, it is daily, and I don't think anything odd or unusual about this at all. It has just so quickly become an active daily part of my life. 17 and a half, I'm expelled from my senior year of high school for the third and final time, all three times because of my drinking problem. May of 1975, on a Friday, I would be committed to a treatment center for alcoholism and drug addiction. My father had tried all human power to relieve me of my alcoholism. And I know if a loved one could, wouldn't have needed AA. He sure tried it all. But he didn't know what to do, and so he sought professional advice. And they said, while you still have legal custody, you need to commit her. And when I showed up 2 weeks later, that's what he did. And I went into this facility completely annoyed, is the nice word about it, because my weekend of drinking had been ruined. I had big plans, and I was willing to go Monday. Really, you know. And of course, they knew me a little bit better, too, and that there was going to be no Monday. And so I was put into this facility, and so I have my first drink on a Monday. I'm introduced to you for the first time on a Monday. I have a Friday. Friday, I as the dates. And I hear these words that I've never heard before. I hear the word sobriety. I hear the word alcoholism. I hear Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never heard those words before. I don't even know what they mean. We would be taken to outside meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on Friday nights. And I just, that did not excite me, let me tell you. Going to a meeting of AA where they don't drink on a Friday night, the best night of the week, did not excite me at all. And so I didn't want to pretend like I was interested or joining up. So, of course, I sat in the farthest back portion I could get myself into. And people did what I'm doing tonight. They were sharing their story in hopes that I would identify, find some similarities. And, of course, they encouraged that, but I've got to find the differences, because if you find the similarities, then you might be one of those people, and I don't want to be one of those people. And when they said things like, you know, if you want what we have, and I did get that y'all don't drink, and I don't want what you have, you know, because I'm not done drinking, and I know that more than anybody. I know there is another drunk left in me, and I knew that. And so I didn't want to get too close to anybody. I heard you say that you hurt a lot of people when you drink. Well, then fine, stay away, because I got another one coming. I would sit in the back, and I would hear them tell their stories, and I would hear people say, you know, I lost my family because of drinking. My mind said, hey, you can have mine, you know. I'm done. They're always talking about my drinking. It'd be a nice change of pace, you know, you're drinking. And so, but yet down here where I really live, I knew it had been necessary for me to leave their home because it was no longer a safe place for them to be. I heard you talk about totaling out cars. My mind said, I have never totaled out a car officially. Now, you know when you buy them, they're square. They start off square. And when you drink and drive like I like to drink and drive, well, they get rounded out with the drunk bumps and things jump in front of you and there's misjudgments in parking and the window had been shot out of it, and my gas cap was a mitten I had stuck in there, okay? It's like I'm driving a Molotov cocktail around. It's just... But when you have to make decisions, mitten or drinking money, you know, gas cap does not win, okay? So you just improvise. And losing jobs. And I always had a series of some small little jobs because I didn't know how to support myself other ways, and always had a little legitimate job, but there were several. And the problem is that, yeah, okay, I guess maybe I was let go and maybe I was fired from a few. But I realized when some of that fog cleared that I had developed in that last year a bad habit, and that I would quit in a blackout. Okay, that's a problem when you show up the next day, you know. It's just, you know, it's just so awkward, you know. And so, okay, maybe that kind of applies. And, you know, but I just tried to keep those things at a distance. And then there were two things I heard you say that really bothered me. And I, in the back corner, I would hear you say, about all those broken promises. And I thought, how do they know about those? Because I began to know that I hadn't been able to keep a promise since I took my first drink when I was 12 years old, because it all was involved and be good at the end of the reprimand and punishment or whatever. And that always meant, we all knew what that meant. That was, and don't drink or take any drugs. And I could do that for almost 2 weeks. There was something about that I could get through the first Friday, but I couldn't get through the second one. And when that second Friday came around, you know how we get just so wound up inside, and it just, there is no thinking involved, and it just kind of all has a flat line on it, and you do what you need to do to get relief, and you don't necessarily think of it like that, but it just seems like all those other things seem to go away. And the other thing was, there was a woman who talked about trying to scrub away the smell. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I've had this funny odor for about a year that I have tried to puff and powder and perfume away. And she says that's booze coming through her pores. And I know that she knows what the smell smells like. And that she's an alcoholic and doesn't drink anymore. If I'm not careful, I might be one of those people. And that's as close as I could get in the summer of 75. I was sent to an all-women's halfway house because I didn't like women. They thought that would be a good idea. And so I would be there, and I was given the guidelines, of course, and I did them. I didn't drink, and I didn't take any drugs, and I went to one Alcoholics Anonymous meeting a month. And, I mean, I'm not going to go to two. I mean, I'm not, like, staying. You know, why would I give any kind of extra effort to this? And after 7 months of the not drinking, one meeting a month program, I came to Northern California to visit my mother for a 2.5 week holiday. The first week I'm there, I'm hanging around with people I used to drink with. And the last week and a half, I'm drunk and loaded with them, no surprise. In and out of a blackout that whole week and a half, and every time I'd come to, I'd think to myself, it's the California booze and drugs. If only I was with my old friends and playmates and playgrounds, it'd be different. But I had been in enough meetings to prove two things right. That no, that is not true. You very much may have the problem. And number two is that there is nothing worse than a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. It is a bad combination. Alcoholics Anonymous will ruin your drinking, and it ruined mine. And so I returned to Minneapolis, and my attitude was, I've learned my lesson. And so I stepped my meetings up from one a month to one a week. That sounded like a lot of meetings to me on the not drinking, going to some meetings program I was devising. And again, not quite ready to, you know, like look joined up here. And after 5 weeks of that on a Friday, I got a letter in the mail that had one joint in it. And I thought, hey, you know, yeah, I'll keep this. You know, you just never know when you might need it. And it was so amazing I needed it the next day. You know, it just, the timing was so amazing. Yeah, right. I had no power over that because I had no power. I had no God. I had no connection created at all. So it was absolutely no surprise of my choice. But that was the 7th of February, and I had no plans for the rest of my life beyond smoking that one joint. And I did, and I had no idea that that would be the last mood-altering thing I would take to this moment. It was not my plan. It's not my plan to ever get sober. But what happened is it disturbed the inside of me so much that what happened for me is that I died. Not physically. At 18, you're bouncing back and you can make the look good easy. But I had been so empty and so zeroed out and dead emotionally, mentally, and spiritually that it finally was the last thing that made that flat line on the heart monitor happen. And I died and something else began. There was a moment of pause, and a thought that was not of mine seemed to come in, and instead of all the objections and why my case is different, those people in AA seem to know what to do. I'm 18 years old when I get sober, and a lot of people have asked me, wasn't it hard to get sober so young? My honest, heartfelt answer is, I don't know. Because, you see, I removed all the differences of age, man or woman, length of time you had, whatever I was trying to find before. I removed all of the differences. And so I don't know. I knew at that moment I was ready for the first time to go to any lengths, to follow the path thoroughly to the best of my ability. I knew that. And on February the 8th, 1976, I went to that one meeting a week I'd been going to, and I asked the most important question of my life. I said, what do you do to stay sober? End of question. There's no debate about what your answer is going to be, or, well, maybe not. I don't have to do that. I don't know what you do, but my life stinks and I'm running it. And I don't want to keep breathing anymore if this is the way it's going to be. I didn't need to say all that. I conveyed that with my question and my demeanor. And they knew I meant business too for the first time. And they said, well, what we do is one day at a time, we don't take the first drink or anything else that affects us from the neck up, and we have a sobriety date. We go to a lot of meetings and we get a home group. We get somebody that we can talk to, and that's a sponsor. We take these steps and we develop a relationship with the God of our own understanding. You know, Deb, those traditions, those aren't just for the group, but learn how to apply those in your own life as well. And we try to carry this message and to be of service. And so they set that bar high. And I started this journey and I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous with everything. I had an enthusiasm and a willingness and an energy that was just full. And I finally got that sponsor. I had some people as a sponsor, but until I got Margarita, I really got grounded with that. And I had a home group, and I was launched into this land of sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a little shy of my fourth birthday when I moved to Atlanta. And my first last name was Fegan, and now my last name becomes Richards due to a profession I was interested in getting into. And my home group there was the Skyland group, and I got Joe P. as my sponsor. And he passed on with 53 years of sobriety and was active up until he was unable to be active. And he was the best example in that area I knew. And I took a four-year cake, and all of a sudden what crept into my mind is, you know, you're 4 years sober. You know something now. I have no idea where that came from, but the problem was I listened, you know. And I thought, yeah, I know something now. And I went from, you know, 7 meetings a week sure is a lot of meetings. I think I'm going to trim that back a little bit to 2 or 3, and it very quickly became 2. Now, I didn't check this out with a very experienced sponsor. No, no, no. I'll take other stuff to him. But 2 meetings a week became what happened. And what happens is when I shrink it down, I'll shrink it down some more. And after 2 years of doing that, I am 6 years sober and extremely restless, irritable, and discontented. I'm unhappy and I'm just crawling around in my skin. I'm thinking I'm 24 years old, 6 years sober, probably going to live a pretty good long time, but I hope it isn't going to be like this. And I failed to look at the things I had changed. I had changed instead of getting to my meetings real early. I'm getting there 5 minutes before they start, walking, get my coffee and sit down, because that's all you have time for in 5 minutes. And instead of being one of the last people to always leave my meeting, it's amen, shake, shake, and you're looking at taillights getting out of there. If you could have heard my head after that second meeting, it'd be something like, well, got that done for the week. Now, I didn't have big plans of service or education or anything like that for the other 5 nights of the week. It was all just more me. And I'll tell you, you start circling the drain kind of fast on that one. I did. At 6 years sober, I didn't look at that. I looked at people, places, and things are going to make me happy. Now I had a little revision to that, and more appropriately, it was going to be men, money, and mansions are going to make me happy. And so I set out on my journey, and 3 weeks later, on a Friday, I met Lo Fella. And he had all the qualifications I was looking for, even been sober for 13 years. Hadn't been to a meeting in 3 years, but you know what? No problem. I'm going to hip him. And I sent out to hip this little fella. Of course, he didn't want any of my hip, but he was going to get it. You know, I'd learned perseverance here, by gosh, and we're going to put it to use. All for self-centered, self-serving reasons, but what really happened is that light switch of insanity got flipped on inside of me, and I was just as crazy as I have ever been in sobriety. I was really kind of in sobriety. I was not an active member. I was no poster child. Nobody was sending newcomers over to me to work with. They were just hoping I would, you know, kind of land back here in the middle of you. But what happened is that after 3 months of this whirlwind romance, of which I was the only one involved, I know, I hate those kinds, you know. this little fella, he married somebody else, and so I let him go, and don't give up, though. Keep persevering this sick path of recovery. And I did, and I found another little fellow a little while later. We did this dance of delusion for 3 months, and off he wandered off down the aisle with somebody else. And at 6.9 years of sobriety, I came crashing down one more time. And I was the same place emotionally, mentally, and spiritually as I had been February 7th of 1976. Flatlined out. But this was different. I know now something different. I know that I am looking for relief and that I've got only two avenues as an alcoholic, either drink, which for me had proven not effective, or recommit myself to Alcoholics Anonymous 110%. And for me, what that definition is I know all the things to do. It's do all those and then a little bit more. That little bit more has always been my life-saving cushion. And that's what I began to do. I began to take these steps again as if I'd never seen them before, and they felt new and different, and I felt revitalized and reconnected and back on track in all areas of my life. At 8.5 years sober, I'm feeling just a twinge of restless, irritable, and discontent, and wondering, why can the enthusiasm just always stay there, full tilt? And the speaker was up sharing that night, and he talked about being a number of years sober and feeling that way, and he said, you know, I realized I was trying to live today on last year's program. And I thought he spoke right to my heart, my actions. That's what I'm doing too, darn it. I'm kind of still patting myself on the back for making an old amend that was long overdue. I'm still thinking about that. And he completely gave me a new way to think about one day at a time. This is the day to be present and to be of service and to do my bookends of prayer and to answer my phone and to do my best to make sure my life is as clean as can be and to do the right thing. This, and then that hopefully launches me into the next day. Gave me a new way of what one day at a time meant to me. A few years later, I would get married and I'd move to Southern California. I lived in Long Beach. My name would then become Harris, and then I was a member of the Bellflower Big Book Group, and I was there for almost 14 years. That marriage would come to an end just shy of 6 years, and one more time. I'm about 16, 17 years sober in that area. And, you know, I'm just, my ego is hurt. I'm embarrassed. I feel like a chump, a big fat loser. I've got all the negativity inside, but I also know that I am just here to try to apply the program of Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time and to be the best example I can when life happens to you. Because life will happen. There is nowhere in our literature that says it won't. But what has happened in my life is that I have had people way ahead of me who've gone through bigger things than I will ever know in a lifetime, that I got to use their strength and courage of example to do whatever has been presented to me. And it's kind of awkward at times when you're all in the same home group. You know, nobody got custody of the home group. And what you get to do is learn how to place principles before personalities. And I got to, you know, I love work in the room. That's what I do. And I shake hands. And whether they're a new face or a familiar one, that, you know, that's my job. That I take on every time. And my guideline for me was, if I knew where they were, I'm not doing my job good enough. I should be completely immersed in being of service. And so that was how I did it, one meeting at a time. And Thanksgiving came around that particular year, and it had been about maybe 6 months or something like that since we had separated. And I'd been doing fine for the most part. I mean, sure, in pain and hurtful and all that, but it just hadn't gotten me. And then that Thanksgiving day, it just all hit, you know, and the tsunami of self-pity was on its way. I mean, I could just see that thing coming out there. And It's like, bring it on then. And I'm standing in the wall of that house, and it just started coming up from kind of getting watery-eyed, and then a few drips, and then it's crying, and then it's kind of weepy, and then you're just sobbing, and you're just kind of sliding down that wall, and you're just letting it go. And I slid down that to the floor, and I just, you know, okay, you got about another half hour to let it rip, and then you got to go get your shower and get your face on and get your dress because you have a greeting commitment at the meeting tonight. You see, I've always known that the commitments I make for the tomorrows of my life have saved my life. I don't have to be spiritually fit to show up and be the greeter. Nobody knows that but me. I don't have to be mentally competent to open the door and get the coffee on. You know, it helps. I mean, but we don't check for that for sure. I just know and have learned and experienced, Deb, just get the body there. All that stuff will come when the meeting comes alive. I count on that. I count on it. And I've never, never been let down. And I went on, and I had to realize that, you know, it is so true in my case that whenever I'm pointing that finger, I got three coming back. And I had to take a look at my own inventory and see that I have no knowledge or clue whatsoever on how to be a partner in a marriage. That selfish, self-serving, self-pity, self-centeredness aren't really tools to bring to the table of a marriage. Won't really be much there. And I had a lot of work to do if I am ever going to be prepared if somebody is to be in my life. And so I began the business of preparation. And I began to do some things differently, and I began to have a little bit more dignity about myself as a woman and make different decisions. And after 8 years of a single life, at a convention, I would meet my husband Kent in April of 2000. And in April of 2001, we got married, and Benoit was there at the wedding, and we had just a wonderful, happy occasion. It was a really celebration of time. And a year later, in April of 2002, we were back in Atlanta. And this was the last of the important people, places, and things for Kent to meet in my life. And Friday night, back to Friday night, we were there and went to that old home group on Friday night, and it was just exciting to be there and see so many friends. Saturday morning, got up, said my prayers, please help me stay sober today. That's always a part of that morning prayer, even this morning's prayer. And the rest of the things I say, communicate with God, get on with our day. We went on to this luncheon with some non-alcoholic friends of mine, and we're at the luncheon. And I'm 26 years sober. And we sit down for lunch, and there's some pre-poured goblets of wine there. Now, I've been around wine my sobriety. I mean, I don't go running toward it. I don't try to be around it, but I've certainly been around it. And it's never been a problem for me to say no thanks. I'm usually offered, get a chance to respond. But oddly enough, this time it was there already. And I confirmed what the beverage was, and I pushed it out of my way. And I'm not here to psychologicalize anything of what would then happen, but what happened was that this event seemed to generate or kick off for me a 6 months physical craving to be drunk. Now, it's baffling to me because I am so in the middle of you to prevent this very thing. And I'm not in the middle just tap dancing. I'm in the middle. I'm in the trenches. I'm working with new people, to people with numbers of years of sobriety. I'm active with a sponsor. I'm doing all the things. And my belief has always been that if I'm doing everything I know to do to the best of my ability, and then some more, and making that protection plan in place, putting it solidly there, then the thought doesn't have a chance to jump in, nor does the craving. So if the craving came in, what's wrong? What am I doing wrong? Where is the link? Where is the weakness? And it was kind of one of those weird, scary type things, because it just was, when we finished that lunch, I was, You know how when you have those drunk dreams and you wake up and your heart is at 200 miles an hour and you are, it's so real. You are terrified that you've done what was, what we would then come to know as a dream. And you look up at your ceiling and you think, okay, this is my ceiling. This is good. You know the other ceilings. And then you look over and you say, that's my husband. That's better, you know. Okay, so we have not left. We're here. We're planted. Okay, just go. And I kept waiting to wake up. And I just don't understand what's happening. And I'm talking to my sponsor and I'm talking to my husband because, I mean, he sees all the actions I do and don't do every day. And I'm not looking for a justification. I'm looking for, do you see something that's amiss here? And I start taking that inventory of what I have seen people do before they pick up the drink. Sort of the drink they pick up before the drink they pick up. And I know that. And I start looking at those things and asking myself those questions. Are you lying, stealing, cheating, doing anything inappropriate? Are you flaking on commitments, chipping on meetings, little white things here and there? Are you doing any of these kinds of things? No. Are you working with others? Gosh, in my case, the most I've ever worked with. Are you active with a sponsor? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. What about meetings? Minimum 3, usually 4 and 5. Active, early, late, commitment. I'm looking at all this. I'm talking about what is my relationship with God. I assure you that thank goodness my relationship was so strong because there were many times the pull was so strong within me. It felt as if there was this disconnect and that I would have a brownout and drink against my will. That's how strong the physical craving was, and I have not had that since I got sober. And there wasn't the mental obsession, which was another thing that bothered me and felt very strange. It was this physical craving to be drunk. And not have a drinky poo, it was obliteration, you know. And I don't know what's wrong. Just tell me. I would beg, plead, ask, pray, demand, request, whatever throughout this time to God. What is it? What am I doing wrong? I don't know what to do to fix it. Tell me, I'll do it. And there weren't any single line answers. But I kept doing what I had been doing all along before it hit, the maintenance and then some. And I'm at a meeting one morning, and the meeting's over. I'm leaving home, and I'm gripped with that terror that I would drink against my will. And I called my sponsor, and she was available exactly at the moment I needed her the most. And I told her what was happening, and I was crying. And she said words I've heard before. But those were the words that were perfect. And she said, honey, what we have is the disease of alcoholism, not alcoholism. And you know, I know that, but there was this new coat of paint on what that meant to me. That it's not that in my particular case that I was doing anything wrong. It's that I have a disease that had just reactivated itself big time despite all of the things I had done to prevent that from happening and the care I had taken for my recovery. But I also know that it wasn't about what am I doing wrong. It was thank God I was doing everything I was doing. What if I had started chipping away here and there, flaking on commitments, screening my calls, judging more in meetings, getting resentments I won't let go of? What if I had been doing those things? I don't know. I don't want to know. I know that a couple of things, and that is that you can have the craving and you can have the obsession, but you do not have to act on it. I put myself in the place of greatest protection I possibly could. I'm reminded once again in our literature that what I have is a daily reprieve, not a yearly reprieve, not a lifetime reprieve, a daily reprieve. And it's contingent not on just my spiritual condition, but on the maintenance, which for me is a very present thing, the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Every person I see come back to Alcoholics Anonymous that I knew was here, drank, and came back, I ask the same question. And I ask them, the day you took that drink, did you ask God to help you stay sober? And in 30 years, I've had the same answer, no. Which to me means it is ever vital that I ask God for His care, love, protection, and to help me stay sober today, each day and every day, and I hope that you do too. Thank you.